The Witness Protection Program has always loomed large in the public imagination, usually depicted as a haven for turncoat mobsters. But who really lives within the protected realm of the Witness Protection Program? Well, the public doesn't know for sure, and that's sort of the point.
Jackie Taylor was just 7 years old when she and her family entered the Federal Witness Security Program, commonly called Witness Protection, or WITSEC.
We were ushered into black vans, and I remember stopping and switching vans.
It's a program shrouded in secrecy, run by the U.S. Marshal Service. Witnesses in danger are protected, relocated, and given new identities in exchange for turning state's evidence against organized crime, cartels, or terrorist organizations.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. My name is Lisa Zambetti, and I am the casting director for CBS's long-running procedural Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente, my other co-host, is my colleague. Now, you know I usually host this with Jim and Laura, and you also know that they are away on assignment right now on their super secret, fantastic reinvestigation. So, you know, I'm flying by myself, and you know how I get, you guys. I get very nervous, like I'm going to let you down, like I'm not going to have anything interesting to say. But thank goodness one of my favorite people was available, and he came to my rescue. So also with me today is...
Bobby Chacon.
Bobby baby!
Hi,
who are you?
Oh, I'm Bobby Chacon, retired FBI. I work with Jim on a lot of projects, including Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, when it was on the air.
Bobby was my colleague on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, which was an amazing show. Sorry to see it go, but I'm sure there are other things.
Sure. Working on a lot of new projects right now.
Yep. And also with me today, because you guys know I need a wingman. You know I can't do this by myself, and I always think it's more interesting with three people. Also with us today is...
I'm Paul Francis Sullivan. I am the producer of Real Crime Profile, and I'm also the host of the Sully Baseball podcast. And am I allowed to tell people how I know Lisa Zambetti?
No. Okay, we're gonna just skip right past. No, I'm just kidding. You know, Paul is my bewed.
Yes, I'm her. We bewed. You and I bewed, and I also produce the show.
That's right. So one of the reasons that Paul's allowed to be here with me is that I wanted to ask Bobby about something that I know you all have asked me about, and that's the Witness Protection Program. And everything I know about the Witness Protection Program I learned from the movie Goodfellas, which we're going to be talking about. And the only person that I know who knows more than anybody about, besides Martin Scorsese, about Goodfellas is Paul Francis Sullivan.
Yes, it's one of my 10 favorite movies of all time, and it happened to come out my freshman year at NYU. Wow. When everyone there was a Scorsese-ophile. Goodfellas came out like in September or October of 1990, and it played at a theater on 8th Street that was about a block away from our classes at NYU. Right. And so it turned into what are you going to do after class today? I'm going to go grab a slice of pizza and then watch Goodfellas for the 70th time. I saw it probably 10 times in the theater.
Wow.
And the only other thing I know about this Witness Protection Program is the Steve Martin film My Blue Heaven.
Yes, that's what a lot of people remember.
Which is also loosely based on Henry Hill. Right. So in a way, yeah. Goodfellas is a prequel to the film My Blue Heaven.
And Goodfellas is the first movie I ever worked on.
Oh, really? Well, there you go.
You worked on Goodfellas. I didn't know that.
I didn't think you could be cooler.
I was a very young FBI agent in the New York City office, and... As you get the least desirable assignment. So I was put in a conference room for 10 hours a day across from one of Scorsese's assistants and a writer. And I would have stacks and stacks of FBI documents that I would have to redact, which means I would take a big black marker and line out addresses, phone numbers, names, any kind of identifying information. And then I would turn them around and slide it over to them. They could read the document, make notes, and I would take the documents back and shred them at the end of the day. They were all copies of the originals.
Oh, I was about to ask you, like, if you redact something here and that's not permanently erasing it.
No, that's record. Right. A redaction is for publication. The original always stays, secured in the file, but do you redact any kind of identifying information? And I did that for several months with the writer, with one and a writer's assistant, actually, and one of the assistant producers on that movie. Because Henry Hill was a informant on my squad. So when I got to the FBI office in New York, I was assigned to a squad designated C-17. C-17 was the Lucchese organized crime family. That's what we did. C-16 mm-hmm. was the Gambino crime family. That was John Gotti. That right. was our sister squad. Our squad was Gaspipe, Anthony Queso, and Vicar Musso. So they were the boss and the underboss of the family. So Henry Hill was a member of the Lucchese. He was an associate of the Lucchese family. So the Paul Sorvino character in Goodfellas was based on Vicar Musso, which was our boss. Which was so when you walked into my squad area, we had a big chart of the Lucchese family, and the Paul Sorvino character would be at the top, and we had the underbosses there and things like that. So I've met him. I've met the boss. Because when one time we had a hit put out on him, we heard over a wiretap, well, the FBI now has to go and notify somebody. In the old days, you didn't. Then they got whacked, and then there was a lawsuit against the government because you didn't tell the guy. Oh, you know, wow. You had information that they were trying to kill him, which they're trying to kill each other all the time anyway. But, you know, we would go and we would talk to them. We'd go into their social club or their, you know, they'd be playing handball down at the courts, and you'd walk up and say, you know, we have information that we can't tell you how and we can't tell you what, but we have information there's a threat on your life, a credible threat on your life. And they'd look at you with this, like, shocked look, this feign of shock, and say, well, I don't know why anybody would want to kill me. I'm a plumbing supply salesman, or, you know, whatever their cover was. And we go, oh, that's fine, but we need to let you know. We need to document this in our file. Oh, thank you. I'll let my lawyer know that you guys came by. You know, very gentlemanly, very friendly. But, you know, so I've met the Paul Sorvino character and some of the other type of characters in that. And I used to field some phone calls at the squad from Henry, because Henry was already in the witness protection program when I got there. So all of that happened before I got there. So the movie was actually in pre-production. And so I was helping with a lot of the, you know, the administrative tasks that would had to go into the finalization of the Bureau approving some of the script elements.
But when you tell them there's a hit on them, don't they know, like, oh my God, you must be, you know, recording them? I mean, doesn't that tip your hand on your intelligence gathering?
Well, yeah, but it's a liability thing. We didn't used to do it until, you know, then liability started attaching, and so they started suing the Bureau and the government for civil liability, because you knew, you know, the wife would sue because the husband got killed, and we knew the husband was going to get killed, kind of, you know, that kind of thing. It's when you have credible and specific information, you have to pass it on. Now, if you think about it, it doesn't tip our hand for them. It tips. Now, he knew that we had a wire up on his enemies. He knew we had a wiretap because he can figure out how we found out. Right. You know, we either had an informant in that group, but it isn't his group. It's a group that's trying to kill him that we're following. So, you know, as soon as we left, I'm sure they put their heads together and they started trying to figure out, you know, how, where the information came from and who it was. But in reality, they probably already knew. They know who they're warring with. They knew who they have beefs with, you know, so they know kind of, you know, who's coming after them. This is just like a confirmation that, yeah, there's a hit being planned. So it may speed up their defenses and stuff or their aggressive, you know, actions towards the other.
Would they always act in the way with the phony incredulity? Yeah. It would just always be like, I don't need, even though it's been like, you know, it's like how many times do we have to come here and said, you're, oh, yes, you just have your plumbing supply company.
Right. Yeah, it's that way all the time. They always kept up their cover, you know. I mean, and there was even a scene in the movie in Goodfellas where the De Niro character walks up to a car with the two agents and he gives them a hard time, and I think Ray Liotta's character says, I'll leave him alone. You know, like, I would often, they would wave to me, you know, when we were surveilling them, or we'd sit in front of their house and they'd kind of wave. The older time guys were very deferential. They were very respectful of us. Sometimes the younger guys kind of got a little aggressive. Nothing too stupid where we would be able to arrest them. But, you know, they'd curse at you and stuff. When the older guys, the older mafia families, they knew it was only business. I'm there, it's my job. He's there doing his job, whatever it is, you know, and it's just part of the game that they played.
How active is the Cosa Nostra now? I mean, it seems like such a throwback thing.
Yeah.
You don't really hear about it anymore.
It's much less active now, yeah. I think. You know, in the late 80s, actually, you know, around the time Henry came in, which was the mid 80s, in from the cold and turned. In the late 80s and early 90s, we had a whole series of guys kind of turn. Obviously, Sammy the Bull Gravano being the highest ranking one. He was the underboss to John Gotti, who was the boss of the family. So when you have an underboss, he was the highest ranking mafia guy ever to turn and testify against all the family. So you, but you had Picciotto, you had a number of different mafia captains, or capos, turn and cooperate with the government and testify. That hadn't happened for an entire 50 years before that. But when Henry went down, and then there was a series of higher guys, upper level guys, and that decimated the families in the 90s. And I don't think they've ever fully recovered from that.
I have, that's right around the time I moved to New York. I moved there in the fall of 1990, is when I was a freshman at NYU. And all the Gotti trials and everything were front page headlines. You know, every day, and of course the and it was also the release of Goodfellas and the anticipation of Godfather 3.
Yeah, it was the heyday of the mafia.
And I remember this is just an anecdote of what that was like there. The NYU was in Greenwich Village, and I would go, and oftentimes with my cousin Michael, he would come down. He lived in New York as well, and we would go to Little Italy to to have a great dinner. And you would walk through the village. East Village was really grimy then. This was pre-Giuliani. It was really grimy. You cut through Soho. Soho was a little dangerous. Then you got to Little Italy. There was no graffiti on the walls. There weren't the bars over the windows. And it's because you didn't know. If you spray painted someone's house, you had no idea whose cousin that was, whose brother that was. Yeah. And you would go have a great, we would have a great meal at a little hole in the wall. And it was cash only,
right?
And we saw there was these two young college age women who ate this nice big meal, and they reached in and they grabbed their American Express card. And my cousin Mike and I were looking at each other, going like, "Oh, I hope we see those two girls again someday."
Yeah, I mean, you can still go to Umberto's clam house and see the bullets in the wall from some of the mafia hits. They left them in there for, you know, for tourists and stuff like that.
La Mela was another place. There's a place, there are all these great places that... Mm-hmm. That
yeah, and the FBI office was 5 blocks from there. Mm-hmm. So we all walked there for lunch.
Oh. Yeah. Wow. Well, I think a lot of what our listeners kind of want to know is, other than if you're in organized crime, what would make somebody need to go into the witness protection program? And is it mainly for organized crime?
No, I mean, that kind of glorified the program. The program actually started in like 1970 or 71. The law was passed in 1970. The program was then funded in 71. The program's actually run by the U.S. Marshals Service, not the FBI. But any federal agency can put people in there. But you have to apply. You have to apply to the Marshals Service. And there's an application process that happens. And it takes a long time to get somebody approved. In the 70s, it was a lot of white-collar criminals. And then now that's actually come back around with the Madoff stuff and the Enron stuff. So, you know, it was actually geared a little bit towards these white-collar criminals. And then later it became a thing for the mafia guys. And then I put a number of Jamaican drug dealers, Jamaican drug kingpins, Colombian drug dealers, kingpins into the program. But I think that the mafia movies like The Godfather and like Goodfellas, I think that kind of made the program a lot more colorful to the public and got them to know about it.
So who puts them in? Is it the law enforcement? Is it the lawyer? Is it the family themselves?
No, it's the law enforcement agency, the arresting. So myself, as the arresting agent, would apply to the Marshal Service for one of my guys. And it would be me in the U.S. Attorney's Office, actually, the prosecuting body who was prosecuting that guy. Because they're all pleading guilty to something to get into the witness protection program, usually. It's very rare that you have somebody going in that's a strict witness only. It's almost always what we call a cooperating witness, which means they're a bad guy, but they're cooperating and being a witness for us. It's very rare that it's just a regular witness. Although a regular witness can go in, it just doesn't happen that often because it's a very, very difficult program to be successful in.
When you talked about some of the white-collar criminals, were their lives in danger? I mean, is it always about someone's life in danger? I'm picturing, maybe I'm being naive, but I'm like one of the people involved with Madoff or Enron. Are someone going to whack them?
Yes. Yeah. You're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah, that's very likely, or it's very possible. It has happened in some of those cases. It's not very publicized and stuff, and it's not as brutal as, you know, as a mafia hit in the street, but it has happened. It continues to happen. When you know, it's all about money, right? So when you're talking about hundreds of millions, tens of hundreds of millions, I mean, Madoff was probably in the billions if they ever really got to the bottom of it. And Enron, you talk about Enron, it wasn't so much the money figures, but they ruined people's lives. I mean, literally ruined people's lives. My brother-in-law, you know, my own family, his life was ruined. His marriage was ruined because he had a career of 40 years with the same company in Portland Gas and Electric, and he had a vested pension plan, and he had a 401k, and he lost it all. And at 55 years old, he was out on the street with not a dime and not a job. And what do you do at 55 years old when you've lost everything? And everything you worked for has been in that 401k and that pension fund. And Enron came in 18 months, they bankrupted his company. You know, that puts people in a much desperate situation. People have committed suicide over those things. And harming people that were responsible for that is not beyond the pale.
So it's not so much that he was they're getting rid of a witness, they're just getting revenge. Right. So that's why they're right. In danger. Right.
If they're going to testify in open court, they're going to reveal themselves. First thing you do as a witness, you have to admit all your bad stuff. That's what the prosecution makes you do, so that the defense doesn't have you the gotcha moment. You know, the prosecution, when you go up there, they go, "You did this, didn't you? You did that, didn't you? You did this." So you try to get everything the guy did as a witness up front, and then explain why he's, you know, so the defense doesn't have any kind of surprise. So in admitting to all that in open court, there's going to be people that aren't going to like you so much, you know. So you're protecting your witness that way. It's not necessarily from a co-defendant. It's from somebody that witness is on the stand admitting he ruined their life.
Most of the more than 18,000 people in witness protection are not witnesses, but actually family members of witnesses, many of them innocent bystanders caught in the middle.
And how willing are most of these people to going into the program? Do you have to convince them, like, hey, you are in danger, you need to enter this? Or are they, I mean, how does that all...
You know, it's a process to convince someone to go in. Because when you actually sit down and talk to them about the program, and reason why most people are not successful in the program is it's just like you can imagine. They tell you you're not allowed to have any contact with anyone in your previous life. Anyone. Brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, moms, dads, nobody. Who can do that? I mean, I personally, I don't think I could do it. I've talked guys into going to that program knowing that I couldn't do the things I'm telling them they're going to need to do. To cut off all contact with everyone. Now, the reason that most of them aren't successful is they do reach back and they try to talk to people in their old lives, and the marshals find out and they get like three strikes kind of thing. And, you know, but it's a tough, tough thing. It's not an easy, I mean, think about just cutting your entire life off. Your entire life, everyone you've ever known. Nowadays, I don't even know how they do it with social media, because most of my guys went in before social media existed. I don't know how you do it, you know, if you had a high profile on social media, and then, you know, you're not going to be on social media again, you know, because people are going to recognize you. So it's a serious thing to consider. It's a hard thing to be successful at, to just cut off everyone in your life. Every relationship, every family relationship, friendship, everything has to go.
That's one of the most amazing scenes in Goodfellas with, I believe it's a real FBI agent who is speaking to Ray Liotta and Lorraine Bracco when they're going into there. And he's just very matter of fact. Yeah. What about my mother? What about her?
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't an FBI agent. He was a prosecutor. That was Eddie McDonald. I worked with him extensively. And he was the head of the Organized Crime Strike Task Force there in Brooklyn that we worked for. But he was the actual prosecutor in Henry's case. And he said, you know, don't give me the babe in the woods routine.
Yeah, I'll be Lorraine Bracco. What about my mother? I didn't do anything. I wasn't involved.
Oh, come on, Karen. Don't give me the babe in the woods routine.
Exactly.
There we go.
That's Eddie McDonald.
And there was, I'm going to go to this because you know about the program, and this is stuff I've always wondered about. They mention it briefly in that scene, like, I just don't want to go anywhere that's cold. And then and then she tries to say, he has a bronchial condition. She's like, no, I just don't want to go anywhere that's cold. That's right. And, like, obviously you're not going to put them in Miami Beach. Right. You know, you're going to find some place in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
When something like that happens, just tell the viewers, where exactly did you put Henry Hill? Where is our map?
But he can't look like such a fish out of water. Like, right. They can't be in.
Like you were saying.
You
brought up, you said, like, the Colombian drug lords. I'm picturing, okay, we're going to put a couple of Colombian drug lords in Bozeman, Montana. Right. You know, they may stick out.
Right.
They may stick out a little bit.
What even got more of a problem is that. You know, when the program started, it was one thing, but I think there are now like 9,000 people in the program, 8,000 or 9,000 people in the program. You don't have enough room. They'll be bumping into each other, right? Yeah. I mean, and each one gets a team of marshals that kind of control them. They don't stay with them all the time, and they wean them off over a number of years. In other words, in the beginning, they give them a stipend to live off of, but they expect them to get a job. They help them get a job and stuff, and then they wean them off, and then by the end of a certain amount of time, then you have a control marshal, a deputy, that they'll always have the phone number to if they get in trouble or whatever. But they're expected to live their life on their own. So the support kind of is a lot in the beginning, and then it weans and it lessens until they're supposed to be on their own after a number of years. But, you know, that's a two-way double-edged sword, because now you don't have as much control over them, so you don't know what they're doing. And then you get a situation like Sammy the Bull, and he's in the witness protection program, and he's this big ecstasy dealer in Arizona when he got out of jail. So he got arrested again, and then he got thrown out of the program again. So, you know, it's a tough program. It's been successful to some degree, but for Henry it was more successful. For Sammy the Bull, obviously, it was less successful. Some of these guys, some of my Jamaican guys, they, you know, it's tough because these were cultural things, and when you put them somewhere, they're going to gravitate towards other people from that culture. Mm-hmm. And that's where the familiarity comes from. That's where the knowledge will come from. Someone will know, you know, oh, you were in a Jamaican gang or whatever, you know, so it's really tough for them to cut off all those ties. You know, if you put him in Kansas City, he's going to find the three Jamaicans that live in Kansas City, you know, because that's who he is, you know, connected to.
And I think that time is not on your side, because the more time that goes on, the more lax they think, well, you know, especially if the person that they're witness against has been imprisoned, mm-hmm. they must think, oh, well, I'm not in danger anymore. How, right. I mean, are they still in danger?
Oh, sure. In fact, just last week, I actually had to fill out an affidavit for one of my guys that I arrested in 1990, and he served time in jail, and then he went into the witness protection program after he was incarcerated, after he was released, and he got kicked out of the program, and he was still on some kind of immigration status that allowed him to stay, but they revoked that. So now if he gets deported back to Jamaica, his life might be in danger. So I was working with a pro bono group at the Cardozo Law School it's an immigration service, and to try to get him status to stay in the country. And so even years later, generation later, 1990 is when I arrested him. He's been off the street since then. But this was a very active, very violent gang for a number of years, and there were still people back in Jamaica that remembered he ratted some people out that they were related to. So if he got back to Jamaica, I'm convinced he probably would be in danger 30, 40 years later. So you still get that. I mean, you still have those issues. And the person in the program normally has that marshal, and they have a number they can call. They'd be patched through to me. So they can still call me. I still get calls once in a while. It's obviously less and less and less now. But my wife still laughs when she hears me flip over into my Jamaican patois that I speak, because I'm speaking to one of them, and she can't even understand me when I'm speaking to them.
Wow.
But they get patched through a certain line because they're not allowed to know my phone number, and I'm not allowed to know their phone number.
Right.
I'm not allowed to know where they live. Yeah. Of course, there have been times, again, it's a no-no, but they call me directly. When I had my FBI phone and when I was still on the bureau, they had my phone. It didn't come back to me, but they had my number. And they would call me, and I'd see the area code. And I knew, oh, this guy's in Kansas City, or this guy's in St. Louis. And he's not supposed to do that. And, you know, so it's a hard thing. I don't know many people that were fully 100% successful in the program.
I can't stop but thinking about, like, if someone goes out in public. Like if they went to, you keep bringing up Kansas City, they go to a Royals or a Chiefs right. game and the camera is swooping around. I have a couple of friends of mine who wrote a very funny script about two people in the witness protection program, and they win the publisher's sleep, and the cameras show up at their house. Right. So they, all of a sudden, they're revealed right. at this address, and then you see right. their faces. You know, you would think in this world, I mean, we have our social media pages up right now, even as we're recording this, right. that there's some... Someone in the witness protection program is going to post a selfie at one
right,
point.
Right. Yeah, and that, like I said, I don't know how the marshals deal with it now with social media, because anybody, and it's not only them, but imagine a guy goes in and he takes his family into the witness protection room. Now you tell his 15-year-old daughter she can't be on social media. How's that going to play?
Right.
Kids, they live on social media.
Be successful in college. I mean, like, you all of a sudden that the kid grows up to do something not necessarily illegal, but like becomes successful. What they do, does that expose the father,
right,
the mother?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was working on the Lucchese squad, we had a cooperating witness, and he was working for us. So we wired up his office, and nobody knew. And then somehow they found out, and. We got a call from him, panicked call. He was racing towards our FBI office in Queens, New York. And he was like, they know I'm a rat. They're coming to get me, blah, blah, blah. So this was a very spur-of-the-moment thing. We had to squirrel this guy away. I was not part of that team, but they had not started the application for the witness protection program for him yet. They started the initial paperwork, but it wasn't too far into the process. So I got, again, the new guy, one of my tasks was take this guy, me and three or four other agents. We had a safe house up in the Poconos in the mountains of New York, upstate New York. And it was an A-frame on a lake. And we took this Italian guy up there, and we were basically babysitting him for 3 or 4 months while the marshal's paperwork went through.
3 or 4 months?
Yeah, 3 or 4 months. Because part of the process is they have to be interviewed by a three different psychologists, because they have to be, you know, screened whether they're going to be able to successful, whether they're doing it to get into the program, to maybe try to find other people that are in the program. You know, there's a whole bunch of different things
right?
that there's they have to pass three different psychological interviews and stuff. So all of that takes time. And so here I am in an A-frame on a lake, beautiful place, and he's cooking.
I was thinking Paul Sarzano, the razor and garlic.
And the garlic, yeah.
But
don't use too many onions. Not too many onions.
They always put too much onions.
Yeah.
But, you know, this guy would sit there every night, get on the phone to his wife, spend an hour trying to talk into the program, and she's like, no way. She's cursing at him. You ratted everybody out. My family is disowned us. You know. And it was like, you know, it was kind of like the initial scene when Henry goes to jail for the first time and Karen's out on the street and no one's helping her and she's crying. So he's talking to his wife, trying to convince her to come into the program. And an hour, and she's not having it. She's a tough old Italian girl, and she's not having it. He slams the phone up, and he's like, you're the only woman, you know, I love you, but... And he's like sitting there, and he's got this dejected look on his face. And all he does is pick up the phone, without missing a beat, dial a number, and it's girlfriend number one. And he gives her the same speech. She's the only one. Come in. And they'll protect us. We'll have a new life together. Blah, blah. The same speech. And from what I hear on the phone, he's getting the same reaction back. She's not having any of it. Boom. Phone gets slammed down. Picks it back up. Girlfriend number two calls her. Girlfriend number three. He must have called like half a dozen girls, women, to try to get them to come into the program with him. You know, because here he is, this, you know, aging mobster. You know, he probably doesn't have a lot of game left. He's going to be put into some environment that he's not familiar with. And
doesn't want to be alone.
Yeah, but yeah. It was kind of an eye-opener watching him try to sell them, and none of them were having it.
Gerald Schur, now retired, founded the Witness Protection Program.
This is a large country, and border to border, we can find plenty of place to hide people. We may have to furnish translators when they go to see a doctor, but it can be done.
So you said something about the psychologists have to pre-screen them, but once they're in, it seems like they would need even more counseling.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of, I don't know what the marshals provide. It's kind of an interesting thing, because once you release them into the program, you don't hear back from them for almost forever. And the marshals don't talk to you. And I think that's part of the,
yeah,
the reason. They want the least amount of contact, even from us. Because you never know who's watching or who's tracking you, or right. You know. So they it's a really like a black hole, as it should be. Once they're in, they're in. You don't hear from them. You don't know where they are. You're not supposed to reach out for them. If they need to come back to testify, the prosecutor has to call the marshals. The marshals have this whole thing where I've met with them. They actually fly into an airport from somewhere else. They don't tell you where they're coming from with the guy. You fly into that airport, you meet in the airport hotel, you interview him, you prep him for his testimony, they bring him back to wherever he is, you go back to New York. I went back to New York, and then, you know, because you have to prep a witness a couple of different times, and then when he comes for testimony, they bring him, you know, through three or four different airports, they fly into Philadelphia, and they'll drive him into New York. You know, they do a whole bunch of stuff like that to protect the guy. And so I've been involved with that, where the guy's already in, and I've had to fly to an airport hotel, and they fly in with them, and they don't tell you where they're flying in from. So it's all very secretive, you know, as it needs to be. Mm.
So as far as the protection part of witness protection, is there anything more than reestablishing that new identity? It sounds like they get a stipend, but as far as the protection, are they monitored?
I think it depends. It's an individual thing. It's a case by case. Most of them, the overwhelming majority of them, don't need that kind of protection, because the whole premise of the program is you're putting them somewhere with a new identity where they're going to blend in, and they're going to just assume life. If you've got five guys in dark windowed SUVs all around this neighborhood, that's going to defeat the purpose. That's going to bring attention. You don't want attention. You want them to just blend into the background. And so that's how usually they do it. Now, so many bad guys have actually gone into the program, like Sammy the Bull. And one of my Jamaican hitmen that I put in there, he did 10 years in jail. And so much of that was happening. The Bureau of Prisons created a jail just for people that were going into the WITSEC program, or people that were cooperating. So you know how, like in prison movies, you often see like there's a separate cell block just for the cooperators, the snitches they call them. And you know, if there's ever a prison riot, they always go right for that so they can kill all those guys because they were the snitches. So what the Bureau of Prisons did, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they created a whole prison. Every inmate in that prison was a snitch. Every inmate in that prison cooperated with the government and testified against somebody else. So there was no problem with that. Nobody resented anybody else because they all did it. Right. That's where Sammy the Bull Gravano ended up, and that's where one of my guys ended up, and they were actually cellmates in that facility.
Wow.
And they all usually serve their time in that prison, and they get released into the witness protection program. So my guy got 10 years in jail because he was a hitman, and he admitted to several murders. And so then after his 10 years, then he went into the witness protection program upon his release from incarceration. He didn't get a free ride. He did 10 years in jail first.
I guess I'm trying to, for whatever reason, I'm thinking about, I know you can't tell some of the details here because it goes against the purpose, but like, there must be like realtors you work with or like people, like contractors you work with that you know you can trust.
Right. Well, you know, that's the funny part. You're right in that I can't tell you, but it's actually so secret. They wouldn't even tell me that. Like, I don't even know that from personal experience. I can surmise the way they might do it, because the way we had safe houses and stuff, we had safe houses squirreled away in a similar manner. I was assuming they do stuff like that similarly. So, yeah, I think that, but I think that they probably establish businesses. We have, the FBI has business, it's called backstopping. And it's a business, and it's a private business that's established. It's been in existence for many years. And it, like when I was an undercover, that's who provided me with my employment history, my credit reports, and things like that. So we have established businesses that anybody looking out from the outside in, it looks like a very legitimate business that's been in operation for a number of years. Now, I'm sure the marshals have something similar, so that when they're buying a house and like that, they don't tip their hand that it's the marshals buying the house or something like that.
Backstopping, that's a term that I learned on Criminal Minds, because they talk about that a lot when somebody's gone undercover with their backstop.
It's a whole division within the FBI. Like guys, yeah, agents go in there and they spend parts of their career working in the backstopping units, and every division has one. Like LA has an office, which would look like a private business from anything on the outside. Nobody would know. And if you walked in there, they would probably give you some fake story. because they don't want walk-ins, but they have a walk-in, you know, just in case somebody came in and said, hey, does Joe so-and-so work here? And they could say, oh, let me see. Yeah, he works here, you know, like that kind of thing. But yeah, so, and then there's a national unit at FBI headquarters that covers bigger things internationally, because now we have international backstopping because we have so many guys working overseas now.
Oh my God. So if you've tried to, if you try to take a person into WetSec, but they, for whatever reason, you can't get them in, what happens to that person?
Well, I know like cities like New York and New York State have their own kind of versions of witness protection. I don't know what department, maybe Department of Corrections, I don't know who runs it in certain states, but I know at the state level, there are state programs like that. If the marshals wouldn't take them, it's a problem, but the FBI would relocate the person and we could get them a certain level of change of identity. It's not the full thing that the marshals do, the package, but we can get them a new name, new social security number, and, you know, a kind of like a one-time large lump sum payment to relocate, buy a place, and kind of live for a little while. But that, and then there's so much less support and they're expected to get on their feet a lot quicker, mm-hmm. you know, because we don't have the resources the Marshals Program has to kind of fund them for the time that they take to get on their feet. So in the rare case that that's the case that we couldn't get a guy in the program for whatever reason, we would attempt a relocation. Now, we've done relocations where we've relocated the person only geographically. So we'd move them from New York to Montana, but they still keep their name and add, you know, their name and social security number and all that. It's a little riskier. But if the case is such that you think just a physical geographic relocation would work, then you can do that. Or, you know, we're able to sometimes get an identity change, you know, sometimes with the help of the marshals.
Yeah. It seems like a TV show that I haven't seen yet is the marshal who, as you say, is the contact, who's the touchstone for the people in WetSec. That seems...
Yeah. No, I mean, the closest thing that they had the handler a couple of years ago, which was really... He was an FBI agent that just handled undercover agents, mm-hmm. which is like, I've been a handler myself. I had a Jamaican undercover working for me for a number of cases, and I handled him. And I was the only guy he would meet while he was undercover. And we'd meet at 3 a.m. at some diner in New Jersey, you know, where we were sure no one was going to see him or whatever. And we would dress in ways that nobody would know what I was doing or whatever. So, but that there was a show called The Handler. Uh-huh. I can't remember who starred in it. I think it was a CBS show. And it only lasted 2 or 3 seasons, but it wasn't directly like you're talking about, but it was kind of similar to that.
I want to see the movie In the A-Frame with the guy calling all of his girlfriends and everything like that. Yeah, I'm already casting that in my head.
Yeah, you know, that's the, you know, when I see a movie like Goodfellas, yeah. and Goodfellas is one of my favorite movies ever, it's a rich movie, but to me, there's so much more richness to it because I know... Like I wish like that scene with McDonald with the prosecutor telling them about you could add so much more to that, but you know, you're limited by the amount of pages in the script. But there were so many different other ways in Henry Hill's story that could have been told, you know, and been just as entertaining. But you have to make those choices as a writer or something, or a producer has to make those choices because there's only a certain amount of time. But that movie could have been, to me, twice as long and just as entertaining because there's all these different things that happen. You know, like I think they ran out of time because at the end when Henry comes off of the witness stand and breaks the fourth wall and starts talking to the camera, mm-hmm. I think that was a sign that, hey, let's finish it up here because we're running out of time.
I read once, to talk about a different great gangster film, I read once that The Godfather, which could be my favorite film of all time, mm-hmm. is not based on a lot of reality. There's a lot of people saying that that was basically the idea of these mafia families being like these dignified kings and everything mm-hmm. was an invention of Mario Puzo,
right.
that he was basically just trying to tell a story of nobility in America,
yes. mm-hmm.
and that it actually became reflexive on the mafia, that before The Godfather, there was just a bunch of guys who do it like these and like, you know, not really sophisticated. Then after The Godfather, they wore their suits, started learning poetry.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely accurate. It was like life imitating art. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be Vito Corleone after that, but Vito Corleone didn't really exist. I mean, you had a couple of old time gangsters, but they were not, they didn't have the house in Tahoe, you know, that you saw in the movie and all that kind of stuff on the lake and stuff. They didn't, they didn't aspire to that. They didn't want that, right? I mean, they still kept their money in mattresses and cash and stuff. I mean, now it's a lot different. But the old-time mobsters, they didn't aspire to the things like he aspired to in that movie. It just wasn't part of their life. But you're right, after they saw that, then it actually became like, this is the way we should be living. Look at how good, you know, Vito Corleone has it, right? And so, like, people like, why can't I think of his name? Paul Castellano. No. I think Paul Castellano very definitely looked at those movies, and that was kind of, he was being raised in the mafia in the 60s and 70s. And I think Paul Castellano definitely kind of took that cloak of, I could be this, you know, this dignified businessman kind of thing, you know. And I think you're right. I think that came from the movies and before, because my dad worked the mafia in the 50s and the 60s, the NYPD, and he hated them. He wouldn't even watch The Sopranos. He was like, that glorifies it, makes them look a lot smarter. And The Sopranos didn't make them look that smart. Yeah. But my dad was like, that even makes them look smarter than they actually are. You know, and when I was on the wiretaps in early in my career, when I listened in on their conversations, I mean, a lot of them were really dumb. And these were guys that knew, like, you'd know their names if you were reading the newspaper and stuff. And they would just, you know, especially when they talked about football, they were taking old hundreds of thousands of dollars in bets, millions of dollars in bets for the Super Bowl. Around the Super Bowl, everything became like really busy. And you'd hear them talking about football, and they knew nothing about football. But they would, I think they thought they knew about football, and you'd hear them have these conversations about football, but what they were saying was ridiculous, was utterly ridiculous.
I don't remember who it was. It was some thing I saw about Gotti. This is around the time I was at NYU, and Gotti was constantly in the news, and there was someone who was, I think it was an FBI listening in on the wires, and Gotti in public try to portray himself as some sort of Don Corleone figure. Mm-hmm. He dressed impeccably well. He was the Teflon Don. He kind of walked around with dignity. But the guy said he was listening to on the wiretap said, this is a man with no imagination how he talked. Everything was motherfucker this, motherfucker that. Yeah. And that he said he would bet on anything. Like if two like cockroaches were on the ground, he said, I'll bet you the one on the left gets to the end of the wall, gets to the wall first. And so he would bet on that. Like he was just a degenerate gangster, a degenerate gambler dropping F-bombs, but wanted to portray himself like he was Brando.
Yeah. He tried to wear that cloak of class, and it just didn't work. I mean, it didn't work. And he was the most famous mobster, but he was very short-lived. And you call Paul Castellano the guy he killed to take over, ran the family for decades, and then Gotti comes in, and he's only there a couple of years because he wanted the publicity. He liked the publicity. He liked the spotlight. And that was his downfall.
I always thought that Joe Mantegna's character in Godfather 3 was basically the answer to John Gotti.
Oh, you think? Okay.
That he was kind of, that he was very, Joey Zaza was very, very public, showed up to the San Gennaro Festival with the Cadillac. Right. That was, when I saw, it could be I saw Godfather 3 while all the Gotti trials were going on. And of course, I'm a big Joe fan, not just because of Criminal Minds. He wasn't on it yet, but it was, but he kind of held himself the way that John Gotti did. Like he didn't care that he got publicity, but the older bosses kind of looked down on him anyway.
Yeah, he didn't have their respect. Right. Yeah. And that's true. I mean, if you look at it, that's when, you know, the heyday of when the mob got taken out was when Gotti was there. You know, and he part of him being taken down. And I can tell you this absolute truth, that because the Gambino squad worked next to us, we had little Caseys, and that we were in the Queens office. The other three families, the squads that handled the other three families, were in Manhattan. We sat next side by side, our squads. Those guys, and it was the time Gotti was ascending to power and was in the news, and they worked extra hard to get him because of how he was in the press. And now, I'm not saying agents don't work hard. We all worked hard. I worked hard. My squad worked very hard to take out the Lucchese family. But when you work all day and you go home and the guy you're, you know, attempting to get is on front and center and acting like a big shot on TV, that's just a natural motivator.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you get, you know, I'm not saying they worked any harder than we did, but they were certainly more motivated because he was basically thumbing his nose at law enforcement and at the government and everything.
That's why he was the Teflon. They called him the Teflon Don because everybody knew. I knew. I just got there from Palo Alto. I knew that who he was.
Sure.
Everyone knew who he was.
Right.
And but they couldn't get him. They couldn't arrest him.
But he died in jail. He died in an 8x10 concrete closet. That's where he took his last breaths, you know. So, you know, he was it's so Teflon. The Teflon wore off after a while. It's like that nonstick coating on a pan. You use it a while, it's going
to... Tends to flake off under pressure.
Because he wasn't as smart as he thought he was.
Right.
Bobby, any of the people you've worked with that you've put in the program, do you have any emotional connection to them at all? When you work with them so long to get them in, to get them protected. I mean, and I'm sure that most of them are just horrible guys, but do you at all connect with them?
Sure. I mean, look, like the guy that I spoke about earlier, who's, you know, they're trying to deport him now, and I'm working to get him to stay in this country. He turned his life around. You know, he was a bad guy. He was a corrupt Jamaican cop first, probably killed people in Jamaica, came to the U.S. and was basically a muscle in Brooklyn for a drug organization. And, you know, but I developed him as an informant in the street. I was working him for a number of months and years. And, you know, he was a key cooperator in my case. I took out a very large international violent narcotics organization based in large part on his testimony. And he was successful in the program. He ran afoul of a couple of the rules and he got kicked out. But he's the guy. I mean, these guys are never your friends. But, you know, I always liken it to friends of mine who worked crimes against children. And when I arrested some of these guys, you know, you arrest them first thing in the morning and you're with them all day. We're processing and you have lunch and you basically have dinner and you're waiting to see a magistrate. It's an all-day affair. And you're tired because you've been up for days. And, you know, I could develop a rapport with somebody like that. This is a kid who, you know, especially in Brooklyn, they were making economic decisions. They didn't have any educational opportunities. And they saw people driving BMWs and that was the lifestyle to get into. You know, it was an economic decision. And so, you know, I could almost understand where they were coming from. And after a while, if they agreed to cooperate and wanted to turn their life around, I would do everything I could for them. However, if I never did crimes against children, but my friends did, and we talk, and to arrest somebody that is successful in business or whatever, but is targeting children, you know, maliciously and doing extremely terrible things. That's a person I couldn't spend a day with and buy a Coke and buy a sandwich and have lunch with while we're waiting to see a magistrate in the hallway of some courthouse. That's just not something I could do.
Right.
So I won't say you ever become friendly with these guys, but one guy that I put in three brothers at one point, and they were all separated, obviously, but one of them went to jail first and then was in the woodsick. But he got into a ceramics class, and he would send me ceramic pieces that he would do in jail. My FBI desk had like three or four or five different, like little, one was a Buddha, one was an elephant with its trunk up, and he would put a little card into it, and he'd say that I saved his life. You know, he'd probably be dead if I hadn't arrested him and gave him the opportunity to, you know, turn his life around, and now he was doing this pottery stuff. Of course, people are like, check inside, it's probably drugs inside, or it's probably painted with some kind of poison that it's going to leak out and infect you or whatever, and, you know, they would bust my chops about it. But, you know, so you do develop that kind of relationship where, you know, there was one guy, he couldn't, unfortunately, he wound up killing himself years later after he got out, but he was so thankful to me for turning his life around, and he got out and became like a half-baked like music producer. He's trying to make a living and I think he got hooked on drugs again, and he couldn't get the monkey off his back. But he was a guy that I would talk to as a person, not an animal, not a criminal, just as a person, and tried to, you know, what are you doing with your life? How are you getting yourself straight? You know, can I do anything else to help you?
Yeah. Kind of. There's not a one size fits all kind of criminal. I mean, I wonder, did you ever get blowback from the victims' families for, you know, putting so much effort into getting them away, or, you know?
No, I mean, I don't know if it's designed that way, but it's kind of like we were separated from that. You know what I mean? We have victim witness in the FBI. We have victim witness coordinators and people who specialize in dealing with victims and getting them the resources that are available to victims and things like that.
Yeah.
We don't kind of get involved in that. And I don't know why, you know, it's just the way it's structured. And, you know, my relationship has to be with the bad guy, be it good or bad, be it if he's going to fight me and I go to trial with him, or be it he's cooperating, he's going to be a witness for me. You know, that's the relationship I have to have. The witnesses are handled by, a lot of times, victims by the prosecution, and there's people in the prosecutor's office that handle that, and there's people in the FBI that handle that. It's just my investigation was always... Now, don't get me wrong, like when I moved into forensics and I was doing the dive team, I was all about the victims. That's all we did. We were looking for victims underwater. And, you know, so that was a change. But when I was an investigator focusing on the bad guys, you know, yes, there was, we looked at the victims, but we got the victims in touch with the people that they needed to be in touch with, who could get them the resources and all the things that were available to victims. But I didn't get any, I didn't get much blowback. I mean, I know like there's times when I've heard like the mafia guys, when you put a hitman behind bars and all the people he killed now come out and say, hey, why did you get him such a great deal? He killed my dad. You know, I know those things are out there. Those stories are out there. And, you know, I don't have any
sure.
personal relation with that. Most of my guys, even the guys that were killers, most of the people they killed were other drug dealers. Mm-hmm. It was a drug dealer on drug dealer crime.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And so there weren't many sympathetic victims in the cases that in the murders that I went to trial with. Most of the people that got killed were, you know, were killers themselves.
Yeah. Oh, maybe.
Sasha, you have to laugh. Does Sasha have a question?
I was just thinking, Bobby, last week I was speaking to Detective Christine Menina, who's
oh, yeah,
a
Christine.
You?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We met her at CrimeCon.
Yeah, I didn't meet her there. I guess you guys met her, but
sure.
I, you know, had a Skype with her last week, mm-hmm. and she was talking to me about how hard it is to have her witnesses mm-hmm. come mm-hmm. forward, and they have, compared to what you're telling me mm-hmm. that your, you know, mafioso mm-hmm. protection has, these witnesses have zero all protection. Right. I mean, you all basically right. can give them advice, but they don't mm-hmm. get there.
You
no
want me
reason.
To do some of them?
That's okay.
Okay.
That's
it's probably his time. It's usually his dinner time.
For our listeners, that's which dog is that?
Sasha.
That's Sasha, the dog, who is has no podcast as far as I know.
But he has his own Instagram page. Because he was born in Sochi, Russia, during the Olympics.
Oh, my gosh.
He was one of the Sochi strays. He was an NBC star during the Olympics back there.
And you got to bring him?
Yeah, we rescued him in Sochi. He was 5 weeks old in the snow and all by himself because the Russians were killing all the stray dogs in the Olympics.
Jesus. Anyway, I was talking to Christine, and she was just, you know, she tries to have people, you know, be safe, and
right.
and but they have no resources to protect.
No, the local detectives oftentimes don't. Like I said, New York City, of course, is a big police department, a big state, and they have the resources to do some of that themselves. But and it's only in most big cities. A lot of times in small jurisdictions, they just, it's a very, very expensive proposition you're talking about to relocate somebody, to give them, you know, initially maybe some protection, but a lot of support. I mean, it's an expensive, expensive program.
And it seems like this would only be, you know, locally, sorry. Here, come here. But locally, it wouldn't be as expensive because this is temporary. I mean, protecting one of her witnesses so
right.
they can actually testify,
oh, yeah, yeah.
you know, but they yeah. still, you know, and a lot of times they don't believe that they're really in danger,
right.
that they can sort of outrun it.
Right.
And she said, anyway, okay, what do you want?
I think he probably has to
go out. Oh, okay. Should we wrap
up? Well, if that's ever a sign to wrap up the episode.
Well, Bobby, baby, it's so good to see you.
Thank you very much.
And
for
thank
me.
You for coming on. And, you know, we could talk about so many things. There's so
I
many
know.
Things to talk
well,
about.
You started with Goodfellas. That's one of my favorite movies. And I actually had some role in the movie, you know, in the pre-production.
That's right. Karen! Stir the sauce!
I have a friend named Karen, and I can't talk with her without going, Karen, why did you do that? You know,
where's my hat? I gotta get my hat.
Well, Karen didn't want the hat.
No, I know. Anyway, we could
the cross, lose the cross, right? Lose the cross. Lose the cross.
You're half Jewish, just the good half.
All right, Bobby baby, we're gonna sign off,
okay.
and I'm sure that I'll have you on again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this is RCP signing off.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.